Welcome to First Response, a podcast from First Liberty Institute discussing religious liberty with those who are defending it. I'm Jeremy Dice, one of the attorneys here at First Liberty.
And I'm Justin Butterfield, another attorney here at First Liberty.
Well, Justin, sometimes when you're in the middle of an effort, as we have been for the last 10 weeks, it's a little easy to lose perspective. With so much going on, so many letters being written, lawsuits being filed, and media interviews being conducted, I know I can forget how we got to the point we are at today.
Yeah, I know what you mean. You and I have had too many late nights lately and more all-nighters than maybe some of us even pulled back in college. But it's all been worth it. It's good to take a breather, step back, and look at where we've been and think about where we are trying to go, though.
That's exactly what we're after in this episode. When all of this started, we paused, looked around, assessed the situation, and then started making plans based upon the data. Our mission didn't change, but our focus necessarily did. We sort of pressed pause on a number of the cases on our docket to focus heavily on COVID-19-related engagement. In fact, that's how this podcast even came about.
That's right. We knew from the beginning that there would be debate over religious liberty in the intervening weeks, but perhaps we didn't fully anticipate how far-reaching or long-lasting those debates would be. So to help us look back over the past few months of work defending and discussing religious liberty in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, we decided to bring in Kelly Shackelford, our boss, onto this episode to help us sort through where we've been.
Yeah, and a brief programming note. Justin and I recorded this episode earlier, and as you will hear, we may be pretty decent attorneys, but we're still learning how to produce a podcast. I guess you could say we're a little technically challenged.
You can speak for yourself, Jeremy. I have a degree in electrical engineering with a specialization in computer engineering.
Well, which is why your portion of the podcast sounds pristine. Unfortunately, my side doesn't, and as you'll hear, neither does Kelly's recording. It seems we had a temporary static problem, probably a cord that just needs to be replaced. Thankfully, it doesn't last very long, so if you can just push through the first 3 minutes of Kelly's interview, it will return to normal pretty quickly. So I apologize for the problem, and thank you for listening extra hard to Kelly's insights.
Now admit it, Jeremy, you just forgot to turn off your white noise generator, right? Blaming it on the cables?
Well, I admit nothing, but maybe you can just think about it as that static as some sort of white noise that's supposed to help everyone relax, something I think we're all in need of right now anyway. And truth be told, while it's a little annoying, it's actually not that bad. It's just a little bit distracting. But without further ado, here's our conversation with Kelly Shackelford. All right, well, our guest today is no stranger to either of us, since Kelly Shackelford serves as president, CEO, and chief counsel of First Liberty Institute, where Justin and I are both attorneys. Since 1997, Kelly's leadership of First Liberty Institute's legal team has participated in cases from local municipal courts all the way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. And we've succeeded in over 90% of the legal matters we've taken on. Kelly is a constitutional scholar who has argued before the United States Supreme Court, testified before the U.S. House and Senate, and was named one of the 25 greatest Texas lawyers of a quarter century by Texas Lawyer magazine. While he is a highly sought-after speaker and frequent guest on national programs, Kelly has graciously taken the time out of his very busy schedule today to talk with us today. Kelly, welcome to First Response.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly, I thought what we might do today is walk through these last few weeks so you can kind of give everybody a sense of how things have progressed and then set all of it in the greater context of the greater battle over religious freedom in this country. So to start off, take us back nearly 3 months now to the beginning of this pandemic. Every business has had to adjust, and they had to do it almost immediately. Help us understand how we as a legal organization viewed the looming pandemic and then how we might serve the nation during this time as it all started.
Well, it was an interesting time, actually. Right as we went into the pandemic, we were having the greatest success I'd ever seen in the area of you know, religious freedom in the over 30 years I've been doing that type of work. And when it happened, we had a meeting, as you're well aware, and just said, hey, look, we as an organization have to rethink everything right now because everything is different. So we need to get prepared for what we see coming and to realize we need to think outside of the box and really be ahead of ourselves. And so one of the first things we realized is there would be huge issues for religious freedom because the very entities, churches and houses of worship and 501c3 religious organizations that are the ones that tend to do all the serving during this time, the reaching out, the helping the people in need, were going to come under all these restrictions. So we knew that there could be some real dangers here and that we were going to have to come really to the side of those who were serving people probably in a number of situations. And we wanted to be wise in how we did that.
Well, Kelly, our first position towards this crisis came, I think, as a little bit of a surprise to some. We said three things. First, we said that houses of worship need to continue to serve their communities. Second, we said that temporary and evenly applied restrictions on our religious liberty are probably constitutional. And finally, we said that any permanent restrictions on religious liberty would never stand. Why was it important for us to start with those kind of three ideas?
Well, I think the important thing was some people like to take these sort of extreme positions and say, well, you know, the even in a pandemic when people are dying, the government has no role in protecting public health, and therefore the church can just do whatever it wants, and these religious groups can do whatever they want. Well, of course, that's not the case. The way the constitutional law works is if the government has a compelling governmental interest, like, you know, protecting public health, it does have a role to step in, and it is going to restrict some freedoms. The key is those have to be rational, they have to be narrowly tailored, and they have to be temporary. And so we knew that that was be where things start, but that over time, probably what would happen is there would be some government officials, some government agencies that would like their new power, and even when the public health dangers would recede, they would actually want to keep the power and reduce the liberties. And so we knew we had to start out right and appropriately and rationally and not allow really the extreme positions to rule the day, especially when there had been no precedents in a pandemic before, and we knew those first cases were going to be very important.
Well, then the initial shock began to kind of go into our system as a nation. We went into lockdown. We began to settle in from working from home. Then the next big wave of action, I think, if I seem to recall correctly, came right about Easter weekend and the week after that. That brought a battle over a drive-in church service in Louisville, Kentucky first, and the first court decision concerning religious liberty and a pandemic. What was so significant about that week of Easter?
It was huge. I can't even understate how important that was, not only to religious freedom, but just to freedom, period. Because if you'll remember back at that time, people were watching things they never thought they would see. A father being handcuffed in front of his child for throwing a baseball together at a park. Somebody coming off the ocean, you know, by themselves, being arrested for being on a paddleboard. People were just shocked. And they wondered, have we lost our constitutional system? And so, again, our strategy from the beginning on behalf of religious freedom and churches and houses of worship were, we don't want to take the wrong case as the first case, because there's no law, there's nothing in the history of our country on how this works in a pandemic. We wanted the right facts, the right case, the right place, and we really prayed hard about that. And God gave us a number of really key cases. Mississippi was one of them, where we had a small African-American church. They were driving in their cars, parked in the parking lot, surrounded by police cars, saying you cannot have a church service in your own cars, where nobody's going to catch the coronavirus from one automobile to another. It was just insane, right? They even told this African-American pastor, this is the police officer, on film, quote, your rights are suspended. And now that is the type of extreme case where we can get the constitutional parameters reinstalled. And so the really big one was, at about that same time, was Louisville. In Louisville, they had told On Fire Christian Church there, not only could they not have a drive-in service in their cars again, but this is Easter weekend. They were just trying to be safe but have something communal. But they said that, this is the governor and the mayor, they were going to actually send police officers in across the state and write license plates down of anybody at church on Easter Sunday. And then they would be following that up with all kinds of criminal threats and quarantining people to their homes. And so we realized on Good Friday we had to file suit, and we filed suit. The great news is on that Saturday we got a strong, strong decision in federal court from Judge Justin Walker, that really sort of, I call it the shot heard around the country, you know, kind of like the beginning of the revolution. Everybody realized the Constitution is in place. He said this was outrageous, this violated the First Amendment, and it wasn't even close. He said that this was a violation of free exercise, it wasn't rational, it was discriminatory, because you could be in the cars in other parking lots, you just couldn't be in your car in a church parking lot. And so it really was a strong setting of the parameters for religious freedom during a pandemic. But again, I think even more than that, This is an historic case that really restored everybody's confidence that the Constitution was still in place in all situations. And so I think it was one of the most important victories I've ever seen, and it really did start things off well.
Well, Kelly, right on the heels of those extreme and rather aggressive cases where government officials were really attacking the protected rights of religious exercise for churches, right on the heels of all of that, we thought we initially had some good news. The White House and Congress started talking about a relief package, and eventually the CARES Act and the Paycheck Protection Program arrived. But even that had some initial problems that almost prevented it from helping the religious community. I wonder if you could discuss what were those problems that we had to address with the CARES Act, and what were we able to do to help protect the houses of worship and religious organizations around the nation?
Well, the CARES Act had as part of it the Paycheck Protection Program, where people were able to get their payroll, essentially 2 months of their payroll covered, so that people didn't have to let anyone go. And what a lot of people didn't realize was this wasn't just for for-profit businesses. It also included nonprofit businesses, including churches. And so churches and 501c3s and religious nonprofits were all included. Well, it was an 800-and-something page bill fairly hastily passed, and so we and a number of our network attorneys at some great law firms all were reading through this because we wanted to make sure there wasn't something in there that could reduce the freedoms of churches and religious 501c3s, and we found something, which was it's not actually in the bill, but the bill pulled in the SBA, another agency, and that agency had regulations that once you received any money through them, you now could not, quote, discriminate on the basis of religion, for instance. Well, of course, churches and houses of worship have to be able to discriminate on the basis of religion, or else they couldn't be whoever they are. That's like telling a Baptist church that they have to hire an atheist for a pastor. Or, of course, they can make religious decisions. That's who they are as an entity. So we realized that if something wasn't changed, all these churches, all these nonprofits across the country were about to have all these strings embedded into them, and they didn't even realize they were coming. So we immediately reached out to the White House, we reached out to the Office of Management and Budget, reached out to the DOJ and said, look, you got a problem. And we were prepared to file lawsuits across the country to protect our churches and houses of worship, but we said it would be a lot better if they would fix the problem. And the great news is, on the very first day, it took a lot of overnight work, but on the very first day that you could file your applications, the interim rule was released saying that they were making clear that those normal strings did not attach to religious 501c3s like churches, and that they had total religious freedom. They could protect, they could get that money, still not have the government try to tell them what to do with regard to religion, and they were going to be safe. And so it was one of those things where we protected really every church and religious nonprofit in the country, and they don't even know it. But it was a great victory for really religious freedom across the board.
It was a hugely important piece of legislation, and critical that we'd gotten that victory within it as well. Well, now let's kind of fast forward to where we are today. America is beginning to open up again, and one of the things that we're concerned might happen or would have happened at the beginning is that we're starting to see this today. That is that some state officials, given a little bit of power, are really kind of holding on to that power. What's the next big battle over religious freedom as America begins to open up again?
Well, obviously, the drive-in battle we won, the idea of driving in. But now we're getting back to people coming into in-person into their church service. And this is a lot more difficult because there are, as you said, there are governors who have said that the church will not be allowed to meet until there is an actual vaccine. Well, you know, that could be 18 months. It could be never. So that's an outrageous grasp at power and really just a complete, you know, dismissal of the First Amendment. I mean, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, free exercise of religion. Let's just go after all the fundamental rights, and let's think, well, I'm a governor, so I can now shut all those down for, you know, a year, 2 years, however long I want. We won the first really major statewide injunction, and it was in Kentucky. We filed on behalf of a smaller church in a rural area of the state where it was easy for them to meet and be safe. And we brought that in court. And in fact, the attorney general for the state of Kentucky so agreed with us, he jumped in the case with us on behalf of the people of Kentucky. And we won not only an injunction against the governor of the state of Kentucky, but a statewide injunction. And I just got called this weekend from pastors across Kentucky that said, look, we're going to be as safe as anybody. We care about our people. But we just want to thank you because we had church this weekend. And it was such a blessing. And that's what we need to see done across the country. It's just very difficult in some places because really ill-advised lawsuits have been filed in certain places. They've created bad precedents that then almost feeds fuel to the fire for these power-hungry people who think that they can shut down the church and they can begin threatening criminal action. So we've got a DA threatening one of our churches. And so we're trying to be very wise into how to bridge each of these situations state by state to make sure. But the point I would make, and I don't think people think about this, is that the church is going to be the key to reopening our country. I've gotten called by businessmen around the country. They've said, should we file a lawsuit? Our businesses are being destroyed. And I said, no, because while you have rights, your rights are nowhere near the rights of churches and houses of worship. They're protected under freedom of assembly, free exercise of religion, free speech. If they can't win, you're not going to win. They're going to be the leaders to open up the church. We've got to be wise in how we do it. We've got to be safe. But that is the very key to opening up our country and our freedoms.
Kelly, I'd like to pull back a little bit and set all of this in sort of a temporal context. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic was a crisis in general, but it was also in many ways a religious liberty crisis as well. How did these past few weeks comport with what you've experienced in your years of working to protect and restore religious liberty? Was there anything that was unique about what we've been dealing with in this pandemic? And not only looking backwards, but also looking forwards, what do you think the last few weeks have taught us about the future of religious liberty?
To answer the question, Justin, first, there's never been anything like this. I mean, I've been doing religious freedom work for over 30 years, and I have never seen anything comparable to this in any way. As I said, I mean, we were playing with a totally blank sheet of paper. I mean, there's never been constitutional law and religious freedom during a pandemic. Nobody knew what this was going to look like. And that's why we thought it was really important that our first case set the parameters and be a strong win, which we got. And that, in fact, if you look, we've had numerous, I don't know, 10, 11, I don't know how many of these we've had now. We've won every single one of them so far. And we think that was wise because when you're starting new, you know, a bad decision can create problems for everybody else. So it's been very unusual, but we've been very grateful to the Lord for the opportunities we've had, the way He's positioned things to where we could get these victories, where we could really lead and provide some strong precedents. But on the other side of your question, it does reflect something for the future of religious liberty. It sort of almost is a little bit of an unmasking of what people would like to do. I think a lot of people are shocked when they see a governor or even a mayor in like we had in Greenville or these other places that say things like the church is not essential. Not only that, but the church, you can meet back in, you know, maybe a year and a half when we get a vaccine. It shows that without really being vigilant and standing for religious freedom, we won't have religious freedom. And there are people who want to strip it away, and they're very close to doing so because look at how quickly this was able to be turned. And so it really stresses the importance of really laying in some strong protections for religious freedom. So when people that have this sort of mindset come into power, they can't do what even some of these people are doing right now. It's sort of like, well, we can shut down all First Amendment rights and then all the burden is on you. No, that's not how the constitutional law works. The burden is on the government to justify if it interferes with somebody's fundamental rights, like free speech, free exercise of religion. There are times that it can be justified, but it not only has to be a compelling governmental interest, compelling meaning the government really has no choice, but it also has to be narrowly tailored so that it doesn't strip away any more liberties than are absolutely necessary to meet that important interest. And so saying, hey, I'm here for public health, is not enough. It's got to be, is what you're doing treating the church differently? Which in all of our cases it has. It's treating them much worse than secular businesses, where those secular businesses aren't even protected by, you know, free speech and freedom of assembly and freedom of religion, whereas the churches are. So we're going to have to be really, we're going to have to be willing to stand and to fight, because there are people that want to change our country into something that our founders wouldn't recognize.
I think that's true, and it's been a crazy couple of weeks trying to do all the things we've been doing around the country from the privacy of our own bedrooms many times and working from home and these things. Well, Kelly, thanks for these insights. I know I speak on behalf of all of us at First Liberty and the thousands who partner with us in this effort around the country and saying thank you for the leadership you provide here. And then also thanks for joining us here on First Response.
Thank you for what you guys are doing and getting the word out.
Well, Jeremy, no one knows how things will go when a crisis arrives, and that was certainly the case here when numerous experts disagreed on the seriousness and length of time that this pandemic would present. And Kelly, I thought, did a good job of looking back at what we were thinking throughout this process. One of the immediate things you heard Kelly say is that we had to be careful and strategic on how we proceeded. In fact, proceeding cautiously at first eventually provided us with the credibility we would need in order to push a little harder when we saw problems arise later on. And, you know, given the lack of precedent on religious liberty issues in the midst of a global pandemic, I think the initial caution was prudent.
That's true. And as you heard Kelly mention, one of the first cases ever on this topic came from Judge Justin Walker over Easter weekend. And one of the more eloquent lines from his opinion explaining why he granted our request for a TRO so our client, On Fire Church in Louisville, Kentucky, could hold drive-in services on Easter Sunday, I think it encapsulates the importance of the issue itself. He recalled the experience of the pilgrims who he said understood that, quote, no place, not even the unknown, is worse than any place whose state forbids the exercise of your sincerely held religious beliefs, unquote. That religious freedom or bust mindset of the pilgrims is what has distinguished the American brand of freedom for all these years.
And, of course, we built upon that decision by Judge Walker a few weeks later when Judge Gregory F. Van Totenhove granted our request for a TRO against the state of Kentucky so that our client, Tabernacle Baptist Church, could resume in-person worship services. And Judge Totenhove really picked up where Judge Walker left off, suggesting that the Constitution is something meant not just for when things are peaceful, but for when they are hard.
Yes, he said, quote, but what of the enduring Constitution in times like these? Does it mean something different because society is desperate for a cure or prescriptions, unquote? Well, he answered his rhetorical question by saying it would be easy to put the Constitution on the shelf in times like this, to be pulled down and dusted off when more convenient. But that is not our tradition. Its enduring quality requires that it be respected even when it's hard. Well, you know, that should really be our comfort in all of this, especially in a time of disquiet brought about by a worldwide pandemic. Our Constitution limits government in order to maximize individual freedom.
That's right. And that delicate balance should not and need not be upended because of impending illness. You know, just a day or so later, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit would opine on a similar issue. The court observed that the state of Kentucky seemed to be making an unfair distinction, implicitly suggesting that people of faith were somehow less capable of observing social distancing than secular Americans. In an unsigned opinion, the judges noted that church members simply wanted to be treated equally. And the court said, quote, they are willing to practice social distancing, they are willing to follow any hygiene requirements, unquote, and yet, the court explained, quote, the governor has offered no good reason for refusing to trust the congregants who promised to use care and worship in just the same way it trusts accountants, lawyers, and laundromat workers to do the same, unquote.
Right, which is why a few lines later the court pointed out the obvious, asking rhetorically, quote, aren't the two groups of people often the same people, going to work one day and going to worship on another? How can the same person be trusted to comply with social distancing and other health guidelines in secular settings, but not be trusted to do the same in religious settings, unquote? Well, in other words, Justin, the same people who shop at malls, work at factories, and eat in restaurants go to churches, synagogues, and mosques. Suggesting that shoppers can be trusted to safely social distance, but churchgoers cannot, well, that's discrimination.
It most certainly is. And we should also note an important point Kelly made about this litigation, that if you stop and think about it, one of the driving forces for the courts recognizing limits on government power and ultimately for America's reopening has much to do with churches reminding our elected officials that there is no pandemic exception to the Constitution and that the free exercise of religion must be protected even when it's hard.
That's a very good point, Justin. As Kelly said, businesses, as important as they are, aren't protected in the Constitution, but religious liberty, it is. In other words, our duty to the creator of the universe pre-exists government. And while we might consent to suspending those rights temporarily out of love for our neighbor, they aren't rights that are flipped on or off by the government.
And one of the people who deserve a lot of credit for holding this line is Attorney General Bill Barr. You know, he, along with Eric Dryband, a former guest on this program, I might add, has really done a fantastic job of warning state and local officials to avoid the temptation to indefinitely suspend the civil rights of Americans through overbearing limitations. And, you know, indefinitely is really just a synonym for permanent, and neither approved of by the Constitution when applied to our fundamental freedoms.
Well, that dovetails nicely with another point Kelly made, which is that when we've enjoyed such great freedom for so long, it can be easy to forget that there are actually people who have no problem stripping away our religious liberty. I would hope that does not come from a place of animus towards freedom or towards religious liberty, but even if it comes out of ignorance or paternalism, it is no less damaging to freedom.
Well, that's right, Jeremy. And, you know, this reminds me of why we do what we do, which is that freedom does not defend itself. As Ronald Reagan famously said, freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Well, that's one of my very favorite quotes of all time, and I learned it long ago to never say a whole lot after Ronald Reagan weighs in on a topic.
That's probably good advice, Jeremy. So, as we bring this episode to a conclusion, if you enjoyed this episode of First Response, please subscribe to us on iTunes and or Google Podcasts, and be sure to rate us and leave us some listener feedback when you do.
Yeah, and be sure to visit firstliberty.org. There's always something new on our website to read, to watch, or to listen to, including announcements about our latest legal work, our occasional series called First Liberty Live, and even our other podcast called First Liberty Briefing. So be sure to check it out at firstliberty.org today. But for now, I'm Jeremy Dice.
And I'm Justin Butterfield saying thanks for listening.